name is Akiva Konigsberg, and on behalf of Nowled.com, we would like to welcome all of you for coming this evening. We would also like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors who helped sponsor the event this year. And that's Lezecha Nishma, Shmuel Ben Baruch Halevi, Esther Bas Yaakov, Bina Bas Aryeh, Eliezer Ben Yitzchak, Laura Bas Shmuel, Meir Ben Yitzchak, Sarah Liba Bas Avram Mordechai, Sivya Bas Menachem Mendel, Yaakov Yosef Ben Natan Nata, Avram Yehuda Ben Aaron, Michal Yosef Ben Yosef, Chaya Ruja Bas Chaim, Shlomo Ben David, Chaya Henya Bas Mordechai Chaim, and Bina Bas Svi, and Chana Bas Baruch, and also for Refuah Shleima for Svi Allen Ben Gita. I'm sure that many of you are already familiar with Rebbetzin Heller, but perhaps you're not as familiar with Nowled.com. So, by way of introduction, I just wanted to spend a minute just to explain a little bit about our website. Nowled.com is a website with hundreds of free Torah shiurim, and the membership is completely free. We offer an array of Torah topics, from halacha to hashkafa, parsha, prayer, yom tovim, and much, much more. But what's unique about Nowled.com is that all our shiurim are offered in crisp video quality. You can watch it directly on the website, or you can download it. What's also unique is that unlike other Torah websites, which offer shiurim in isolated topics, on Nowled.com we offer courses of study, where over several weeks and a semester, you can study a Sefer of Tanakh, you can go through Hilchos Shabbos week by week in an ongoing class series, and all from world-renowned teachers. Reverend Tzipora Heller, in addition to being a world-renowned teacher, is also our most popular lecturer on Nowled.com, and we have many, many, many shiurim from Reverend Heller. She's known for her expertise in textual analysis of Torah, as well as Jewish philosophy, and of course her classes pertaining to the role of women in Judaism. One of her very popular classes on Nowled.com is also her question and answer series. And tonight, after the shiur, you will also enjoy a question and answer session from Reverend Heller. Thank you very much.
Hi. Nice to be back with you. I see some of the girls. It's also a great pleasure to be part of Nale, which, Nale is the biggest seminary in the world. It has 10,000 students, and what it is online seminary. So for those of you who miss being in seminary, that's a good, it's a good thing to do. For those of you who don't miss being, in any case, so we're going to be talking about tonight is marriage. So the first thing I want to begin by asking is, why marriage? I don't want to shock anyone. I realize that in Queens people are very innocent, so I don't want to destroy anything delicate inside. But in the world, sometimes people don't marry and have children. Have you heard this? So you could wonder, like the Mishnah says, what was it like before the Torah was given? It says he would meet her in the shuk, and they would be together by mutual consent, and that was marriage. So what did the Torah add? Since it's possible to have children without marriage, since it's possible to find somebody with whom to share your life without marriage, why marry? You all look, yes, why? Okay, what's the interest? Bye, folks, okay, whatever. But, so the reason is what marriage adds is commitment and giving. So if you want to know what marriage is for, it's for those two things. So what makes a marriage halachic, as you know, is kiddushin, which has to do with exclusivity and commitment, and ketubah, which has to do with actual giving in the financial sense and the physical sense. So let's look at these two big ideas, commitment and giving. So when people live together, how long are they going to stay? As long as each one of them thinks it's worth it for me. As long as somebody thinks I'm getting 51%, it's worth staying. As soon as they think I'm getting 49%, it's no longer worth staying. That's because the relationship was always assumptioned on taking. So because of this, one of the least surprising facts, which I found very interesting statistically, is if a couple lives together before marriage and then marries, they're more likely to divorce within 5 years than a couple who never lived together. And the reason for this is contrary to the myth that divorce is a consequence of people leaping into marriage without sufficient thought. Divorce is caused primarily by no commitment to give. So let's talk about why a commitment to give would be a good thing, which is, it seems redundant to talk about, but since we do live in a very taking-oriented society, it's not. So put that question on the side, why is it good to give, why is it good to be committed? When people are surveyed and asked, why do you want to marry or why did you marry? What are the answers you think people get most frequently? What do people want in marriage? What do you think? Some people want security. Some people want a framework in which they could have children. Most people want companionship. Most people want companionship and relationship. So what I would like to throw in as a theory at this point is that companionship and relationship feeds on giving, not on taking. So to understand that, we have to talk about what being a human being is, what autonomy is, what marriage is, and how to conduct marriage. So those are going to be our topics. So let's talk about what being a human being is all about. In the Torah, it says, Naseh Adam Bitzalmenu Kedemutenu. Hashem says, let's make man in our image, in our form. What's Hashem's image? We're told so many times in Torah, I have no image. What's Hashem's image? So, suppose I had a picture in my pocket of somebody who you would all recognize. Take it out. You all see it? The non-existent picture? So let's say it's President Obama. Okay, I'm very likely to carry a picture of President Obama with me wherever I go. So here it is. I take out Obama's picture. I say, what's this? And what are you going to say? Obama. But because I'm a very witty person, I'll say, no, that's not Obama. It's only a piece of paper. Okay. So in that sense, we're in Hashem's image. We have features that resemble Hashem's features. But substantially, we're not like Hashem. He's eternal, we're transient, he's all-knowing, and we elected Obama. Okay, so there's a difference, but we have features that are similar. So these features that we share in common with Hashem are the tselem. So the most observable quality that Hashem has is that he's a giver. Similarly, the aspect of who we are that's closest to divinity is the aspect of us that gives. So again, Hashem says, let us make man in our image. That means that human beings are programmed to want to give, and this indeed is the source of love. However, there's a problem, which is that we're also programmed to take. We're not only spiritual, we're also physical. So the body and soul don't always want the same thing. The body loves to take. The soul loves to give. The soul loves doing and activity, and the body loves passivity. So we're conflicted. So to illustrate this, how many of you have ever been on a diet? Okay, and the rest of you are liars. Okay. So here, in case you didn't know, for those of you who are uninformed, here's how being on a diet really is. You get up one day and you're disgusted with what you see in the mirror, so you say, I have to lose weight. So you go to the store and you buy a book about weight loss, you know, and it has people on the cover who are slender and tan and have very white teeth. Will you ever look like them, no matter how much weight you lose? Never, but whatever. But you believe them. So, and by the way, in today's diet books, they tell you straight off that diets don't work. So, they say 90% of the time people diet and gain back the weight. Diets don't work. This isn't a diet, it's a food plan. Okay. So in any case, you're on this new food plan, so you get up in the morning and you eat fruit. So by 10 o'clock you're very hungry, but it says in the book that you're not hungry. So you're not hungry, so you have 2 cups of water. And then at around 12 you have lunch, and it's very satisfying. You have a large salad, which we all know is like sticks to your ribs. And maybe some steamed vegetables and your protein of the day. And at around 4, you're very, very hungry, so you have 2 cups of water because it says in the book that you're not hungry. And by supper, again, you're even hungrier, so you have a salad and what? Steamed vegetables and your carb of the day. And by 10 o'clock, you're very hungry, so you have more water. Now, we all know that diet has to work with exercise. Have you heard this? Now you know. At night, you'll be getting up and coming back. It's all about water. Okay, so you may be wondering at this time, why am I telling you this? The reason I'm telling you this is here's the scene that will never happen. You get up after, let's say, 2 weeks of this, and you look in the mirror and you say, I decided I want to be fat. This doesn't happen. So how do you end up breaking the diet? Now I want you to hear this part very carefully. You have your moment of truth. You say, I would like to eat some crackers. I'm so hungry. Just some crackers. Just some rice crackers. Okay, and then there's the answer. You shouldn't do that. No. Don't eat those crackers. You shouldn't. It's not on the food plan. Okay. I'm hungry, it's just crackers. Now notice, who's I and who's you? I want crackers. You shouldn't eat them. The diet's over. The diet's over because there was an identity shift. So identity shifts happen all the time. The Torah tells us that we're in Hashem's image. That should be our identity. But our identities shift. We also want to be the animal self. So what does this have to do with marriage? Marriage is about being human. Marriage is about being human. Which is why the institution of marriage is only relevant to human beings. So now, let's go back to the creation story. Adam is in the Garden of Eden. Perfect situation. The perfect person in the perfect place. And what does Hashem say? He says, Lo tov heyota Adam levado. It's not good for a human to be alone. So now we're up to the second part of what we're going to discuss. We discussed what it is to be human. We understand that. It's to be a conflicted being who wants to and could be godly, but drawn towards other. Now we're going to talk about autonomy. God just said it's not good for a human being to be alone. So the first human in the Garden of Eden was completely autonomous. Adam is referred to several times in the text in plural. The Gemara tells us that Adam, at the beginning, had the features of both sexes. Adam was androgynous. But it's not good. God says it's not good to be alone. So in theory, God could have created a whole population of Adams, just like there was a population of elephants, giraffes, sunflowers. So on one hand, God created a singular Adam, and on the other hand, he said it's not good for Adam to be alone. What's not good about it? So there are two basic points of assumption. The first one is Rashi's. Rashi says what's not good about being alone is that a person who's alone and autonomous, notice, autonomous, not just alone, will say, presumably to himself, God's unique in the heavens and is the master of the heavens. I'm unique in the earth and I'm the master of the earth. So I want to relate this to how this would translate into 21st century talk. 80% of the Americans or more, depending on who's surveying, describe themselves as believing in God. Did you know this? They do. But their concept of God, clearly from what American lifestyle is that God's up there somewhere, and who has to take care of my life?
Me.
So what God said is a person who thinks that they have it all, a person who thinks they don't need anybody else, is in the end going to be a person who in their erroneous thought pattern will not only exclude other people, but will exclude God. So I want to put this into feminist talk for a moment. The great fear in early feminism is the fear of vulnerability. You have to be both a woman and a man at the same time in the same body, because otherwise you'll be vulnerable. You should only trust who? Yourself. God says that's not good. So one reason is that this level of self-trust and self-sufficiency excludes him. But there's another reason. So let's take another approach, the one that Rashi doesn't bring. There's a verse in Tehillim that says, Olam chesed yibaneh. The world shall be built for the sake of kindness. Giving requires vulnerability. Giving requires vulnerability. How so? If all I have is money, if I had nothing else, no heart, no mind, I just had money, and you also have money, I have nothing to give you. Real giving has to do with giving what the other person needs and being willing to receive from them that which you lack. So autonomy is the enemy. So what did God do about this problem? He divided Adam into two, Ish and Isha, and from there marriage begins. But there's one more thing that you have to know from the creation pattern before we go into actual marriage. We're told how marriage shouldn't be. It says, and therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. Did Adam have a father and mother in an earthly sense? No. So how could he leave his father and mother? So the idea is like this, and I want you to hear this carefully. What's the relationship of parents and children? How do they relate to each other? What's the parent's role? What's the child's role? The parent gives and the child takes. The parent is the mature adult and the baby is what? The baby. Which is as it should be. In marriage, you don't have that. That's what kills marriage. You can't have a relationship in which you're trying to be the baby. In popular music and in popular literature, people call each other baby. It's not good. Okay, a baby has nothing to give. Marriage is about giving. Okay, so now let's talk about actual marriage. So since we said vulnerability is good and giving is good, that means you have to be vulnerable enough to receive and willing enough to give. Women have to do this and men have to do this. The word shalom means peace, but in Hebrew it's not passive. In English, peace means non-aggression. That's not what marriage is about. The word shalom means whole. It means that they together form a whole where one can give, the other could receive, one could receive, the other could give, where they're completing each other. Neither of them is baby. Okay, so what's marriage for? Marriage is for each one building the other. Marriage is for building. So when people will ask, as they occasionally do, is there ever a time a marriage should end? The answer is yes. If the partners no longer wish to build, if they're destroying each other, then the marriage should end officially because it ended actually. So let's talk about how building takes place. Let's go back to talk about what a human is. You could divide being a human into the following components. There's the physical self, the emotional self, the intellectual self, and the spiritual self. The giving and receiving have to take place on all of these levels. Okay, what's the relationship? What's the man's role? What's the woman's role? So let's skip the man's role for a minute. Okay, there are no men here. Who'll know? Okay. So the Gemara says as follows. What's a woman for? And it answers itself by saying, a man could bring home flax, but you can't wear flax. A man could bring home wheat, but you can't eat wheat. So what does the woman do? She turns the wheat into bread, the flax into a garment, stands him on his feet, brings light to his eye. That's what she does. So that means that his basic role is to provide. Her basic role is to refine and build. So everything about them, in their inner and outer constructions, allow them to take this role, provision and building. Notice what I didn't say. I didn't say giving and taking. Building is giving. Provision is giving. Okay, so now let's work this out on all of these different levels. So on the physical side, when a man signs a ketubah, okay, which is the advantage of marrying somebody who reads the Aramaic and knows what he signs, okay, why did he just commit himself to? Supporting his wife, providing her with food, with clothing and shelter, with his physical presence, to be there for her sexually as well. He has to provide. What's the woman's role? She doesn't write a ketubah. So let me spare you an illusion. Her role isn't to take. Okay? To say more. Okay? Her role is to take what he gives materially and to turn it into something. So in the society in which we live, there's been some corruption there. So I want to give you two examples of the corruption of our society. A woman makes a nice dinner, or even not such a great dinner. A woman makes dinner. What's the expectation? The husband ate it because he's hungry. What's he supposed to say before he gets up from the table? Thank you. And if he doesn't say thank you, what might you consider him to be?
A boor.
A boor, okay. A man works 40 hours a week, maybe 60 hours a week, and he brings home a paycheck. What does his wife say? Nothing! Okay, or that's it? Okay. So... We'll say, oh, but that he's just doing what he's supposed to do. Surprise, surprise, so was the woman who made dinner. Okay, another corruption. You're married to a man, let's say he's a programmer, and he brings home, let's say, I'm not talking about an extravagant salary, let's say he brings home $70,000 a year. You're an aerobics teacher, and you have classes twice a week. And you bring home, let's say, $12,000 a year. So how do you divide the money? What you tell him, what's yours is ours, but what I earned is mine. Are you familiar with this? There's ours and mine. Okay. It's not the way to go. It's not the way to go. You have to take what he could provide because every husband wants to provide. And you have to build it into something, materially. So what does that mean? So I want you to go back a couple of generations to your grandparents' generation. They can count on loyalty in those years. Is that true or not? They could. Not every husband was a great provider. Not every woman was a great homemaker. But they can count on their basic roles being acknowledged and validated through loyalty. That's where you have to aim. Now, before I go further, I want to talk about what it means to be a provider, not a builder for a moment. When you provide somebody with something, suppose you gave your child a birthday present, what would you like to get in return? What do you want the child to do? Be happy. Every husband's secret dream is having a happy wife. This is what he wants more than anything else. So he brings home, and we're still sticking with material provision. He brings home what he brings home. He wants to see you happy. He wants to see you happy to be able to buy what you buy. Happy to be able to go to the supermarket and to fill up your cart. He wants to see you happy. Now let's suppose that he doesn't bring home enough money for that to happen. Is that possible? In today's economic climate, it certainly is. With tuition, with health insurance, let's say it's not enough. So we have to bring God back into this picture. Assuming that your husband is doing his best. Now, his best may not be somebody else's best, right? But he's doing his best. And it's not enough. This isn't between you and him. Who is it between? You and Hashem. It has nothing to do with him anymore. If he's doing his best, then you should be thankful to him because he's doing his best. But you have to speak to Hashem about the problem. And because of this, in the Gemara it says that the bracha flows down to the house in the merit of the woman's prayer. So in another class, a woman said, a young woman, we used to call them girls, okay, a young woman, like, that's just like one more thing, you know, to guilt us out about, you know? Like, you know, like, if he doesn't earn enough, I own the problem because it's got to be my davening. Guilt, guilt, guilt. Okay, whatever, this is it. So, of course, I mean, the honest answer is yes. But, you know, welcome to Judaism, the religion where there's enough guilt for everyone. He can feel guilty about not bringing, she can feel guilty. You know, there's always enough guilt. Okay? That's why you're Jewish if your mother is Jewish. Okay, so, in any case. But besides that, you know, you could look sometimes at what Hashem does. You look out at a tree could have 10,000 leaves. Hashem, who creates 10,000 leaves on a single tree, could surely give you what you need. You may have to redefine need. Okay, let's go further. Let's go down. Okay, we have emotional needs. Now, this gets tricky because men and women are different, as I'm sure you've noticed. So I want you to picture this scenario. Your husband is standing by the window late at night, looking out into nothing. And you walk very quietly up behind him and say, "What are you thinking?" What's he going to say?
Nothing.
Is he happy you asked him this question? No. But now, it's you looking out the window, and your husband says, this is not going to happen, but your husband says, "What are you thinking?" And in 3/4 of an hour later, he's got his answer. Okay? Men and women have different emotional needs. Women want most of all to be understood. Men want most of all what? To be respected. Okay? Men want to be understood, and I want you to realize that. They want to be understood, and women want to be respected, but it's a different number one and number two. So, again, your husband wants to give to you emotionally. He wants you to be happy with him emotionally. He's going to try to make you happy. It may or may not work because your need to be understood may be something he's capable of or not capable of. So I want to give you another rule. The other rule is ask for what you want, not what you don't want. So it means, let's say your husband's not home enough. You feel like you've been in the house all day, you need an adult to talk to. You want to sit down, you want to talk. So you say, you're never home. Okay? Instead of saying that, say what you really mean. Say, I like when you come home. I like to talk to you. It's the most important moment of my day when you come into the door. I want you to be home more. If you put it that way, what's he hearing? He's hearing that he could give you what you want. And every man wants to provide. If you say it the other way, you're never home, what is he hearing? You failed. And nobody wants to look failure in the face, especially men who are so attuned to wanting respect. He'll be home less. Okay. Let's talk about spiritually. Okay. And let's put intellectually and spiritually together for simplicity's sake. This is a problem especially in the tshuva community. Okay, a girl comes to Neve. So the only religious men she ever met are who? Rabbis and Shabbos hosts. They're always at their best. They're always dressed in suits. They're always polite. They're always there for you. Is that so? Now, people who grow up in from families and have real fathers and real brothers, they know better, okay? But, you know, for Bala's truth, it's not so simple. So, you get married, and you would like your Shabbos table to be like, you're very reasonable, like Rav Aaron Feldman's Shabbos table. I mean, you know, what's 60 years between you and your husband? Okay, whatever. So, and your husband read Torah tidbits and gave you Dvar Torah from there, and you feel disillusioned and angry. Where is that really coming from? Is it love of Torah? No. It's love of being provided for. It's a different thing. If it was love of Torah alone, then the woman would find herself constantly reading Torah in all of her spare moments. But her need to hear it from him is coming from her desire for support, desire for provision. So again, it's the same rule. Ask for what you want. Don't talk about what you don't want. So even if what he says is very short, say, you know, that changed the Shabbos table. It's so different than when you only talk about politics or whatever. Even if it's 2 minutes, it's a difference. What did he just hear? What did he hear? He heard that he provided for you and made you happy. As opposed to, this is a Shabbos table? Okay, which he heard is failure. This could be true intellectually. This could be true on any level. So let's go back a minute. I want to tie the ideas together before we go further. We said that marriage is about giving rather than autonomy, that giving requires vulnerability, that a woman's role is to build with what the husband provides, that if his provision is uneasy, she has to turn to Hashem, and her way of communication should always be by talking about what she wants and not about what she doesn't want. Okay, clear so far? Okay. Let's take this further. Okay, where does it go? What does it lead to? So what it leads to, ideally, is a relationship not in which people stop being separate. There are three ways in which the tension between being two separate people. And remember, Hashem wanted there to be two. That's why he made what? Two. Okay? Made one and divided. Okay. Between being two and being autonomous is a difficult, is a difficult medium to find. So there are three paths that people pursue. One is where one partner, usually the woman, loses her personality completely. She has no self. Now, if you have no self, there's nothing you could give with, is there? Okay, there's no way to contribute or to build, is there? You're totally dependent and insatiable in your dependency. Do women fall into this? They do. And there's the other extreme, where you have two people living parallel lives, peacefully together under the same roof, but there's no giving either. Neither way is the Torah's way. The Torah's way requires that both people have a self to give, and to give it freely. So how does this come about? So this comes about through having an acute vision of what building means. You can't build unless you trust your ability to build and know what it means. But first acknowledge the danger. It says in the Torah, after Hashem divided Adam into two, Ish and Isha, what did Hashem say he would make? He said that he'll make Ezer Kenegdo, a helper who's parallel to him. So the question is, how could a helper be parallel? So there are two kinds of helpers. Neither of them are good. Here's the first one. Suppose one day, God forbid, you're taking a shower, and you notice a lump where you wouldn't like to find one. So you decide you have to call a doctor after you stop crying. Okay, so how do you decide which doctor to call? You just call any old doctor? No? You just open the telephone book?
You call someone who knows.
How would you know who knows? How would you find the best doctor? You would call Rofe, or you would ask for references from people who you trust. Okay. So they all recommend Dr. Chashuv. Okay. Where does Dr. Chashuv live? Okay, in Manhattan, of course. Okay. So you go to the doctor, making the appointment is a story. When you get on the phone to make the appointment, do you get to speak to Dr. Chashuv? Who do you talk to? You're lucky if you get the secretary. Yeah, if you're interested in an appointment, please press 1. If you're okay, whatever. Okay, so maybe you'll get a human being, maybe you don't get a human being, right? You get to the office, you ring the bell. Does the doctor come to the door like holding a cup of tea, saying, "You must be so distressed"? Is that what happens? No, what happens? You ring the bell, you notice the sign, ring and enter. You come in, you sit down. It's always a bad sign if there are real leather couches. Have you noticed this? If the couches are real leather, you know this will not be cheap. Okay? And real leather and good art, real leather and good art is like, you know, you may as well sign him over your house. Okay? Real leather, good art, and a corner office? Okay, whatever. Okay, so... excuse me. You sit down, you begin reading the magazines. Did you ever wonder about old National Geographics? Did you ever think about how unlikely it is that somebody wants to know how Switzerland once looked? I mean, think about this. Who cares about what someplace in the world looked in 1973? Okay, whatever. So you're reading old National Geographics, finally you're called in. How long will the appointment be? Somewhere between 5 and 15 minutes, right? Will it be pleasant? No. Will he say things like, "Feel free to ask me as many questions as you want"? Okay. Okay, but who says thank you when they leave? You do. Then you go and pay the secretary. Okay, will this be a lot of money? Yes. And who says thank you? You do. And who makes another appointment? You do. Who's helping and who's being helped? Make no mistake, the doctor is helping you. That's why you're willing to pay what you do. That's not good. That kind of helping is not what helping is in marriage. That kind of helping is called codependence, where your need to be needed erases the other person's ability to provide. Do women do this? Yes. Okay. There's another kind of helper. Maria, she comes to you on Friday mornings, and you say things like, "This time I want you to do under the sink more thoroughly." Okay? Now, who's helping and who's being helped? She's helping, you're being helped. But it's from a position of inferiority on her side, is that not so? That's also not the plan. The plan is neither inferiority nor codependence. The plan is keneged, where there's a balance between what he provides and what you build. Okay, how do you know if you're building, by the way? You ask yourself before you open your mouth, is what I say going to build or destroy? And now I'll tell you the other side of Eza Kenegdo. The word keneged not only means parallel, what else does it mean? Oppositional. The nature of a woman, if she's not provided what she needs, and this doesn't just mean financially, it's always easier to tear down than it is to build. Could you see where this is so? It's always easier to oppose than it is to build. So, as Rashi says, Zacha Ezer, Lo Zacha Kenegdo. If he's worthy, she'll work with him, she'll be an Ezer, it'll be Kenegged in the positive sense. There'll be balance. And if not, she'll be oppositional. This is how it's going to be. So as women, our main decision is to build, and this requires having a self to contribute, being willing to contribute, being willing to use what your husband provides, and being willing to question whether you're building or destroying. Is this easy? No. Could it be joyous? Absolutely. So let's talk about why did we get into this? Okay, whatever. So as you observe in nature, everything does do what it can do. Is that true or not? It's true. So there are no birds out there that, like, will say, aviation is just not my thing. Personally, okay, whatever. There are no plants that say, chlorophyll, chlorophyll, I've had it with chlorophyll. No more, okay, whatever. Okay. Women are plugged to build. The joy, the greatest joy in your life is when you could say, I built something. When you could stand back and say, I built this. So that means, let's go through again the levels, physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. When you build, when you make your home look like the kind of home that the Tzelem Elohim could be expressed therein, then you built something. Okay, think Shabbos table. Think playing with kids in the afternoon. Think inviting a guest. You could say, I built this. Okay, now, what's the other side? Because there's always another side. The other side is saying, I am this. Okay, so picture this scenario. It's Erev Shabbos. You do everything perfectly. Your house looks like Bina magazine, which no doubt is Bina is probably responsible for a certain number of the suicides that have, no, whatever. Okay, I'm just joking. Okay, it looks like Bina magazine, and this week you invited someone who, let's say an elderly person, an elderly gentleman from the nursing home. And let's say he felt unwell. And let's say he even vomited. And now nothing looks good or smells good. Okay, if you think you are the Gashmius of what you built, then how will you feel towards him? Hostile. You may disguise it. Oh, don't worry. Okay, but that's how you feel. But if you feel that you're building, and building a home means what? Expressing the tzelem. Then what? Then you'll authentically not mind. Because you've done with your home what you wanted it to be. You made it a place of hospitality and kindness. You've made your home mirror Hashem's image for what a home could be. Let's look at this emotionally. When you build emotionally, what does building someone emotionally mean? How do you build your husband, build your children? This is not a good sign. Yes, build. I don't know how to. With words. Women, it says in the Gemara, there are 10 portions of speech. Women have what?
9.
What do men say when they hear this? You sure it's only 9? Okay. You build with words. The words that you give to your husband are words that show that what? That you believe in him. That you're happy with what he provides. This will build him. You do this to your children. Okay, it's easy to confuse, again, building with having. Okay, I have a husband who bought me a this or a that. That must be he loves me. That's not building. I have kids who got into the best yeshivas. Better than your kids. That's it's not building. At best, it's a consequence of building. The joy should be in the building itself. And the same holds true with intellectual and spiritual building. The joy, the simcha of being who you could be, comes in the act itself, not just in its consequences. So, being a wife and being a mother could be joyous because it lets you be who you want to be. What every woman is plugged into wanting to be is a builder. Somebody who could find their good part, the part that's the tzelem, and give it flesh and bones. So to tie all of these ideas together and to conclude. So what we said is that being a human being means being in the divine image. We said that autonomy is the enemy of this because it creates self-absorption and the illusion of independence. We said that giving is what love comes from and what marriage is about. We said that giving is based on difference. We said the primary difference is that men are wired to provide on all four levels. Women are wired to build on all four levels. We said that simcha comes from actualization. And actualization means using your potentials to build. So now, I'll stop for a moment. We'll be hearing a bit more, and then there'll be time for questions.
Thank you, Rabbi Sinheller, for such an enlightening shiur. Before the question and answer session, I just wanted to take a few minutes to give you some background to the shiur tonight. The reason we chose this topic for the shiur tonight is because our viewers on Na'aleh requested a series on this topic of Shalom Bayis. Now, Rabbi Sinheller has prepared this series for a semester or even up to a year. But unfortunately, while she is teaching a course this semester in Na'aleh, at this time, we cannot afford to have her teach this additional series. To have her teach this series would cost thousands of dollars, which includes the teacher's salary, as well as technical costs, so that all the shiurim are beautiful video shiurim, as well as administrative costs. Now, we hope that you will join with us to help raise the money for this series. And from hearing all the sounds of laughter and looking around this room, I could tell that all of you enjoyed the shiur here tonight. Now, I'm sure you've learned some lessons or ideas from Rebbetzin Heller, and perhaps you might implement these ideas in your own marriage or relationship, or maybe even you would share something with your friend. But now, imagine if you could learn many more lessons over the course of 15 or even 30 weeks. Now, a good marriage or relationship can be transformed to become truly great. But not only could the series on Na'aleh.com benefit your marriage or the marriage of your friends, but it can enhance marriages worldwide. Since the launch of our website 4 years ago, well over 100,000 hours of Rebbetzin Heller Shiurim were watched or downloaded. And in the past year alone, over 50,000 hours of Rebbetzin Heller Shiurim were watched or downloaded. In terms of our membership, from our well over 10,000 female members, almost all of them have watched or downloaded Rebbetzin Heller Shiurim. And I remind you again, our membership is completely free, so I encourage you to go to the website and sign up. Now, if you can please help us raise this money for Rebbetzin Heller's series, you can do so with whatever donation that you can give. We would really appreciate it. And although the series is somewhat costly, if the average person here would give $100 or more, we will have the money for the series. So I thank you for coming again, and I wanted to let you know that all the donations are tax deductible. We're going to pass out some pledge cards, and if you could please give something, we would really appreciate it. And Rebbetzin Heller will begin the question and answer series in a moment. A question for me? I'm sorry?
I mean, it depends if it's a semester or a year. But it comes close to 10,000 first year. I don't know if that kind of breaks down. We're looking for that series, yeah.
Okay.
Just give us one.
Okay, as you're getting the pledge envelopes, okay, you haven't yet asked any questions, but somebody passed me a question earlier. So the question that the person passed was as follows. The woman who's passed me the question said that she goes to Shiurim, she has an active spiritual life. By the time her husband comes home from work at night, he's bushed, doesn't learn at night. On Shabbos, he rests. And what could she do to encourage him to move on spiritually? He's happy to hear what she learned about, but he's not doing any learning himself. So, it's a very complex question, and I want to tell you why. People do what they like to do. Have you noticed this in life? So, oftentimes, especially men who learned in serious yeshivas, will find the kind of learning that's accessible a few minutes here, a few minutes there, isn't satisfactory. And they have no cheshek for it. Or conversely, you have a man who learned in one of the Baal Tshuva yeshivas, who may find going to a shiur very difficult. It's difficult to follow. A friend of mine who's older than I, even older than I, in fact, her husband noticed this problem. He's retired, and he noticed in their community that there were a lot of people who were would-be teachers. Guys who learned in yeshiva who don't learn now, but if they had to teach somebody, they would learn. And there were a lot of would-be learners. So what he actually does is he's made shidduchim between the teachers and learners. He realized that this could only work if the teachers are paid, because that way they feel some chashivas in what they're doing. So he made the shidduchim, and he goes out every night and raises money for it. But the reason I'm telling you this is that the best thing that you could do is to let your husband know what possibilities are around in your area. Not, there's a shiur, how come you don't go? Not that. But, you know, I just saw, like, there are more things advertised this week. Did you ever look into it? You know, that sort of thing. Another is to show real interest if he ever has something to say. But there's a third thing that has to be said in honesty. Somebody asked the late Kloisenberger Rebbe, not the present Rebbe, the one before him, who was a world-class Talmud Chacham. I'm not saying the present Rebbe isn't, I'm just saying that the other one certainly was. About the situation of a woman, when she got married, thought her husband would be interested more in learning than he actually was. And she was prepared to make sacrifices, and she was prepared to be alone at night, and she was prepared for this and for that, and it's not happening. And he said, Hashem, this is the Rebbe speaking, if she was willing to be the wife of a Talmud Chacham, but he isn't able or willing to be a Talmud Chacham, she'll be rewarded for what she was willing to do. Okay, which is a very radical statement, I want you to know, but this is what he said. So the resentment of the woman feeling cheated shouldn't be part of her agenda, because she's not cheated. She should be coming from a place of building where she wants to help him maximize his possibilities by making him aware of what's out there for him if he'd move towards that. Okay, other questions? Dream on. She's worried about her scar, she's worried about her status in the community. It should be like what you're saying. That's what I just said, but it isn't always.
Okay, so can you repeat the question?
Okay, next question I'll repeat, yeah?
You know how when you were saying the third area of being human spiritually or intellectually, and you said there's a problem in the natural world, and you address that problem post-marriage. How about pre-marriage, when a person's dating, where it's not like they already have the package and they have to work with it? How does the person decide, okay, I can work with this or I can't? Because, like, I look at the Rabbi Leah story where Leah had the option to build and provide spiritually for herself, but she decided she doesn't want that. So, like, where do you draw the line and say, I can't work with this?
Okay, so here's how it works. And again, in the Baal Tshuva community, girls sometimes would like to have somebody who's as erudite as this rabbi, but as sensitive as that rabbi, and as well-spoken as the other rabbi, but good-looking and earns a lot of money. Okay, clear? So, your question when you go out is, could I build with this person? If the answer is yes, and there's respect there, and you like him, and there's some attraction, go for it. Okay? If you can't build with the person, you would have to ask yourself, if you're an honest person, why not? It's a reasonable question. And you may find yourself noticing parts of your character that are not as developed as you thought. There's good old Mayagida, what will people say? You know, there's that. There's fantasy. But sometimes the answer will be, I can't build with him because I don't like him, I don't respect him, and we don't want the same things. In which case you say, Asif, we had a really nice evening, but I appreciate that you took me out to such a nice restaurant. In fact, Yaakov didn't even, whatever. Okay, yeah?
I have a question from a different perspective. There are, I know young men, two young men, who are lovely young men, they're in their 30s, and when this one particularly young man, and when somebody has all this matter professional, excuse me later, but like they just don't even want to meet him. He just right now would say, whatever he does is making not a living. He learns every day. He's Shana Shabbos. He's handsome. But he doesn't have a profession. Mm-hmm. Someone says, what's his name? I know, but like, I will give you his name. He's wonderful.
Yes, what's his name?
Well, I've been trying to introduce him, and he's a very close friend of the family. And if a word gets out, you know, and I finally said to one of the mothers of one of these ladies, what is she, does she want to have someone she can sit every night and share her children with, or does she want someone who has a professional who comes home at 8, 9, 10 o'clock, he doesn't have time for the family. You have somebody who wants to sit at home with the family, and yet, he's, so many girls, when they get to that third date, they say, so, are you going to have a profession? What is it? I'm very frustrated by this, as you can see, but how do we interplay these?
Okay, look, you have to... I understand your question very well. Her question is that in our community there's a singles crisis. You've heard of this?
Yes.
Yes. And there are eligible young men in their 30s. Some people will be moving towards the edge of their chairs. Yes. Okay. But they aren't professionals, and people cross them off the list. So I want to tell you where the people are coming from. They're not coming out of nowhere completely. Their assumption in a materialistic society is that everyone wants to earn a lot of money. And therefore, if a person isn't in a profession, it must be that he can't be in a profession, that he's not bright enough. Because avada, everybody wants to earn a lot of money. So since he's not bright enough, why should I marry him? That's what the girls are thinking. You want to know what the girls are thinking? That's what they're thinking. So the truth here, I don't know this young man. Remember, if he's really, if that's really an accurate description of who he is, then you have to find a girl who's bright enough to see through the illusion of material.
This whole builder thing you're talking about, it's like it's just taking it from a different point of view.
It's taking from a different point of view, but realize that the equation the girls are making is that profession equals money. Anybody... money is what people want. Therefore, if he's not in a profession, it must be he's unable to be in a profession.
I think one of the questions is, why isn't he married at this age? And then
you... the girls...
say that same thing. I mean,
yeah, no, that happens also. The girls get into this... You know, they used to say, any club that would take me as a member is a club I don't want to belong to. So, the you know, girls get into that, but that's a different story, yeah? So how do you get past the fear of vulnerability? The more bitachon you have in Hashem, the less reliant you are on other people for your validation. No, what I'm saying is that when a person is afraid of vulnerability, usually their real fear is that they won't be acknowledged, validated, important, etc. Sometimes it's fear of material things. But the more you trust Hashem, the more you realize that you can afford to be a builder and a giver. He'll take care of you.
You know, in the whole concept of Judaism, my foundation is, you know, to provide a giver scenario. It doesn't, unfortunately, meet the corruption of today's world, which Judaism has also corrupted. The cost of sending your child to a yeshiva requires... for most families, two people work,
right,
and it's at least full time. So that whole concept of who's providing and who's giving has been like skewed, but yet we're still getting into the underlying method. So, I mean, yes, the man still the fundamental thought is they want respect, that's what they want, you know, you ask them what you want, but there still seems to be this balance that's never still being addressed in our society, that it's no longer, you know, this world is at home. And so she has all this time to build. She comes home at the same time, comes home late, she has to make dinner, she does the homework still with the kids. It's still imbalanced. And maybe that's also affecting the man as the provider, because he's not bringing But okay, it's not making life easier for the woman, so it's just creating...
You're right. So I'm going to even add some oil to the fire you just mentioned and talk about Kollel. Okay, so let's talk about the entire issue. So in order to talk about the entire issue, we have to talk about Hashem's hashgacha in historical process. Historical process doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's always Hashem's guiding hand taking us towards wherever we have to go. So with that in mind, I want you to notice a few things. When I was growing up, so I'm not taking you all the way back to, you know, the Stone Age. When I was growing up, My mother had to do laundry in the laundromat. People didn't usually have washer-dryer machines in their homes. If she wanted a fish, she wanted fish for supper, she had to go to the fish store. And the vegetables were in the vegetable store. And the groceries were in the grocery store. There was no shopping under one roof. Okay? There were no synthetic fabrics, so everything had to be ironed. Okay? There were very few kosher anything in terms of prepared food, so everything had to be made from the bottom up. So it was a different life. After her life, however, was a million times easier than her mother's life was back in Europe. So here's a conversation you wouldn't have heard. Back in Europe, okay, Daryl is talking to Zelda at the end of the day, where he's been out since like he davened to dawn and was peddling all day. She's been doing heavy, hard work all day. Zelda, you are you self-actualized? Okay. Because her self-actualization was along the lines of building with what he provided. Came the 50s, things changed. So women were not that content with that either. I want to make that very clear. Because self-actualization means you use everything you have. It doesn't mean that you make little pictures out of jelly beans and put them on, whatever. Okay, so Hashem is orchestrating events. In the post-Holocaust world, you have the popularization of Kollel. So this isn't coincidental, but Hashem made it that when it became historically necessary to see that as many men are educated in Torah full-time as possible, women just so happen to have the leisure and the ability and the restlessness to want to work. This is not a coincidence. It's Hashem's Hashgacha. So the way things are today, if you compare it to ancient times, let's go really far back. You read the Eishes Chayil poem, you don't get the picture of this woman who was like living a very leisurely life. Just at home with the kids, on the floor with Playmobil. That's not what you get. She was busy, she was doing, because in those years also a woman had to be a partner in provision. She had a field. She did. Okay, the question isn't just about doing, it's about identity. The woman's identity is still tied down more into building, and the man's identity is still tied down more into providing, even today. A survey done not too many years ago, less than 5 years ago, in an Ivy League college, the kids were asked, what are your expectations about mutuality and sharing household duties? The girls consistently, over 78%, thought it would be 50-50. What did the men think? They thought 20-80, okay, whatever. Now, this was not in a from Miskeret. This was in Ivy League colleges, because men are still men and women are still women. So the problem that women have today isn't that they're busier than they used to be. There was a very brief period of non-busy women, the 50s and early 60s. Women were always busy. The issue is whether you want primarily to build or to provide. Where do you put your energy? So building doesn't mean just making a cake. Building can mean earning money and using it to keep your household going without taking on the identity of provider. You understand the difference? Okay, yeah?
The men are here. So what's the best way for us to sort of give this over to our husband in a nutshell without saying, well, Reverend Hill has said,
why do they have to?
I think that some of the things that you were saying about, you know, how to communicate our needs being met, you would want to express this is what we heard, so that we could then ask in the right way for our needs being met, but some kind of...
Trust me on this. If your old way of saying, let's say, I need you to listen when I talk was, you never listen to me, I'm talking to the wall. And now you say, it means so much to me when you really listen. He'll figure it out. Okay, don't be his teacher, yeah?
Just wanted to clarify a point. When you were talking about giving requires vulnerability, I believe what you said was that the taker really needs to be vulnerable.
The giver also has to be vulnerable because of it. The giver feels like they're losing something if they're not willing to be vulnerable. One of the problems you have in the secular world, more than in the firm world, when it comes to... They have a much worse singles crisis than we do, by the way. I don't know if you're aware of this. Is that men feel, look, I could work, and like I'll buy a house, and I'll this, and all that, and like I'm working for him, what's in it for me? This question, what? I'm losing everything. I'm losing my time. I'm losing my money. I'm losing everything. I'm giving it all to her. What about me is the source of the commitment issues that are making their lives very hard right now. Giving requires being vulnerable also.
Also to be related to the man's anxiety if the gift is going to be accepted.
And if the gift is going to be good enough.
Good enough.
Yeah.
That's a vulnerability.
Sure.
How do we deal with that part of us that is a seeker? How do we overcome that and be more of a giver side?
You have to constantly ask yourself, this has to be your constant question, am I building? You have to ask yourself this many times a day until it becomes part of your character.
But like the same way you said a person's vulnerable, every person wants to see something and wants to feel like they're loved.
So your husband wants to love you and wants to take care of you. Build on that by being happy and being grateful. And notice I said happy first. Give yourself permission to be happy. It's very, like, some women have an enormous problem with this. Everything is going right. You know, the classical, I mean, it's a symptom, it's not a cause. You're marrying off a kid, right? And it's a good shidduch. And she's happy and he's happy. But the caterer brought ecru napkins. Some women will not give themselves permission to be happy. You understand this? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you have to notice what's being demanded of you. And you have to be willing, if you have the self-esteem issue, which many people do, to notice what you've done. Yeah, that was a good supper. Okay, you have to be willing to notice. Look, if I knew... Why do you ask me, why do kids go off the derech? Okay, whatever. After that, we could talk about peace in the Middle East. Okay, whatever. But, first of all, what I'm going to say is going to be very radical, so appreciate that. I'm not sure there's a singles crisis. What I mean by that is the community has grown much larger, so where there might have been, let's say, one person who people would know as being single and older today, they'll know 20 or 50, but they also know 50 times more people than people knew a generation ago. I spoke to Rebbetzin Cutler about this, Reb Schneer's wife, and she told me that in Litza it was even worse. She has a sister who never married. She said there was a brief respite after the war where people were willing to marry with their eyes closed because their need to build was so great. But she doesn't think that it's much worse now than it ever was. Having said that, and I believe that, it seems to me that when people marry, they've lost track of the goal, which is to build. It seems that there's a lot of trophyism in the firm community, both on the side of the men and the side of the women. And it's a problem. Yeah?
Yeah, I just have a comment. You spoke about how the man just wants to see his wife happy.
example of this. Today, my coworker was shopping online for gifts for his girlfriend and for his dog. So he's miserable about shopping for his girlfriend, but he's so excited about shopping for his dog. So I asked him why, and he said, because the dog likes whatever I give it, but my girlfriend is not satisfied no matter what I want.
That's right. I like that. That's good. Yeah.
I'm sorry to say that this probably relates to that very strongly. We talked about that if a man isn't making enough product to do the things you're supposed to do, you can't have a beautiful house, maybe it's right there, or it's hard to hold the kids, or really do basics. And you said two things. One was redefine your needs, which I'd like to know how one does that in a practical sense. But the other thing that I was thinking about is that, you know, because I don't know if it's nature or the society we live in, you know, and the answer is what? We should dominate. You know, we should solve it and the builder and have so much comes on our shoulders.
I told you, no.
Right, but exactly, to somehow feel A, capable, and B, happy about it and not resentful, like, oh, somehow it's all me, right? I have to stop it for it, to fix his stuff, or help the kids, or do the, you know, we are the problem solvers. But we have to tread that line of being overwhelmed with all our jobs today and not be resentful and be able to be like, oh, thank you for this really
hideous
thing.
Okay.
Whatever it takes for this insufficient money that.
Right. Instead of just saying, perf. Okay.
How do you redefine your needs?
So I'm going to just share with you something I saw. I was in different cities, and I saw one of my students. In a certain city in the Midwest, I'm not going to tell you which. I'll tell you, it was Detroit, but it wasn't Detroit. Okay. Okay. So, girls living in Detroit, and but it really wasn't. But it was a place similar to Detroit, where people live in private homes, in which you can leave the door unlocked. Okay. And that's sort of a community. And her husband has a little job, not a big job. He's in marketing, and he's not that successful, obviously. And she has a job also. And they barely stay out of debt. She invited me to her house for lunch. They live in an apartment in a community where everybody lives in a house. And the kids' toys were strewn over the front of their lawn. It wasn't a garden's lawn. And she mentioned to me how great it is that she found a place online where you could buy used toys on a site called Craigslist. And she's one of the happiest people I met this trip. And I want to tell you why. Her eye is on what she has. She has a husband who's a nice guy. He's not a great earner, he's a nice guy. He learns Torah every day. He's a good example to the kids. She has two kids. She's, you know, late 30s, 3012, 3013, you know, late 30s. She's happy that she has her two kids. Okay? She was certainly the happiest person I saw this trip. It would be very easy for her to go in another direction. I'm sure she earns more money than her husband does because I know what her profession is. I'm sure that she could be saying, an apartment. Who lives in an apartment? She isn't even allowed to have a washing machine in her apartment. The owners don't let because they pay for utilities. So she has to go to the laundromat. Doesn't bother her at least. Thank God we have a car, so it's like really easy to go to the laundromat. Okay? So if you and your husband are trying your best, Hashem made a decision for you. His decision is what you have is what you need. You have to change the way you look at what you have. Okay, yeah?
Can you give a few good lines for building kids and their way to presence?
So here, the lines are always the same. Never talk about being, always talk about doing. In other words, don't tell your kid, you're my little princess, because what do they hear? Mommy's laying trips on me. Okay, say, those socks look so nice with the shoes. You made a good choice when we were shopping. That looks great. Okay, don't tell your husband, you're such a chashuva ben Torah. Okay, give me a break. Okay. Say, that was interesting. You heard that at the Shia? You understand this? Always talk about what people do. Expand on it, not who they are, and it has to be true. Stop killing your brother. You ate so nicely with the fork tonight. Get that fork out of his bed. I'm your brother. Okay, whatever. Okay, so you have no choice. It's not easy. You have no choice. You have to count your remarks and see that there's more positive than negative. You have no choice there. I didn't say easy. Okay, Zehu.
Okay. Thanks again, Taylor. Thank you all for coming. Drop off any checks or flex cards outside on the way out. Send your credit card information directly to the flex card. And remember, Taylor is selling the books and CDs. We'll see you on the way out. Thank you so much.
Yeah.